To the Untold History Channel. It is Monday, 24th June. You know, one thing that I always kind of have is like a sad day for me is the 22nd of June, because that's the day that every day starts to get shorter and shorter and shorter. The 21st is like the peak, the equinox, if you will, or I'm sorry, not the equinox, but the solstice. And then every day from now on is starting to get shorter and shorter until December the 20th and or 21st or whatever it is. And then it's like it's the shortest day of the year. So long as that year is beyond us. And now, I mean, you really won't notice anything until probably like October, but it's still, I don't know. It's just one of those things. That's one thing I always like. When I celebrate right around the Christmas time is this all the days are starting to get longer. Of course, that's what really that was what the Christmas celebration was celebrating the days getting longer. I kind of celebrated for what it was originally supposed to be, but anyway, I digress. Thank you, Safari. Yes, I did make it home safely. And tonight I'm gonna start to go down. I'm actually gonna dive into another one of Mike's books. And this is called My Side of the Story, and it's kind of what the title says. It's the German perspective of right before World War II, and I'm just gonna go ahead and dive into the book. You know what? I mean, I have learned so much by reading Mike's books, things that I didn't know, things that I thought I knew and I didn't know. So anyway, I'm going to dive into this, and it's not because I'm trying to celebrate Germany, but it's just because I'm just trying to get a full perspective or an even more a broader perspective on what I think I know. So let's dive in here and let's get the party started here. All right. So introduction, Aesop's fable of the man and the lion. A man and a lion traveled together through the forest. They began to boast of their respective superiority to each other in strength and prowess. As they were disputing, they passed a statue carved in stone, which depicted a lion strangled by a man. The man pointed to it and said, "See there, how strong we are, how we prevail over the king of the beasts." The lions replied, "Well, this statue was made by one of you men. If we lions erected statues, you would see the man placed under the paw of the lion." The lesson: one story is good until another is told. Interesting. A scandal erupted in January of 1995 when the incoming Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, appointed Christina Jeffrey, a former colleague from Kennesaw State University, to the post of House Historian. The major media controversy arose over comments Jeffrey had made in 1986 while evaluating the World War II portion of a program called Facing History and Ourselves, for the Department of Education. Ms. Jeffrey had written, "The program gives no evidence of balance or objectivity. The Nazi point of view, however unpopular, is still a point of view and is not presented." Jewish groups and the national press exploded into rage over the unearthed comments. False allegations of anti-Semitism were hurled at Ms. Jeffrey as the gutless Gingrich left his former colleague to twist in the wind, alone and undefended. Though Jeffrey insisted that the allegations against her were slanderous and outrageous, it wasn't enough to silence the rabid attack dogs. True to his ignoble form, Gingrich abruptly fired her, stating through his spokesman, "Her statement was inadmissible on its face. The historian of the house could never be someone who had uttered those words." But what was so bad about her comments? Why the media firestorm? Shouldn't both sides of every historical event always be presented? simply for no other reason than to satisfy historical curiosity? Our system of justice grants prima facie murderers, rapists, and serial killers the opportunity to speak, does it not? Indeed, convicted killers like Charles Manson, David Son of Sam Berkowitz, Richard Speck, Jeffrey Dahmer, and others have done televised interviews. Even the erroneous and dangerous ranting of Karl Marx is taught, no? Glorified in the American universities. So what is the so gosh darn dangerous, about merely presenting the opinion of Hitler's Germany? If that opinion is as evil and as fallacious as it is said to be, then why not present it to the, then why not present the full story and then logically refute it? Truth is its own defense. So what is there to fear about simply hearing the other side? Do we really believe in free speech and academic freedom, or do we not? Are we like retarded little children that need to be shielded from mere words, or is somebody hiding something? And the purportedly American belief that no one has the right to deprive you of access to information, the purpose of putting together Mein Side of the Story is merely to present Germany's version of the events in regard to the great catastrophic bloodbath known as World War II. This is Hitler's side of the story, revealed in his own spoken and written words. Only the brief Mein Side blurbs and caption illustrations have been added. A pair of wartime addresses by German Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop and one from Japanese Emperor Hirohito are also included. The speeches and writings are all 100% authentic. Some have been slightly abridged in order to avoid redundancy and to keep the booklet to a brief length. Modern court historians and journalists do not deny the content of these addresses. They can't. Instead, they simply ignore them childishly, denouncing anyone who does attempt to resurrect them as Nazi or anti-Semitic. The common theme that runs throughout these addresses is that Germany and also Japan believe that World War II was imposed upon them. You don't have to agree with that assessment. You don't have to like it. In fact, you can even laugh at it. But it is their point of view, or at least their stated point of view. It is a position that until now, you have not been permitted to even hear. Indeed, it is only via the miracle of the internet that these documents have again become accessible to those willing to snoop around and dig up from memory hole of buried history. Do with these words as you will. Don't just shoot your humble messenger for putting these highly interesting addresses together for your consideration. And of course, this is Dahmer, Manson, Ted Bundy, and Son of Sam. So, all right. Okay, here we go. The setting, 1930s. Few people realize just how popular prior to World War II Adolf Hitler actually was, not just within Germany, but also throughout greater Europe. By 1935, after just 2 years in power, it had become clear to the world that the atrocity stories about Germany were baseless. The Jewish boycott effort had failed. Hitler had renounced any claims to the disputed Alsace-Lorraine region, that's in France, and the rapid economic, cultural, and social recovery of Germany was self-evident. Monarchs, prime ministers, politicians, clergymen, artists, and poets from across Europe, were publicly singing the praises of the Führer. Even some Americans came to admire Hitler from afar. Germany was a depressed, demoralized, and ransacked country when Hitler assumed control in 1933. In just 4 years' time, a 33% unemployment rate was brought down to essentially full employment. Once not worth the paper it was printed on, the German mark became the most stable currency in the world. Germany, under Hitler, also experienced a cultural and moral rebirth than even its former enemies. I think that's all. Germany, under Hitler, also experienced a culture and moral rebirth better than even its former enemies, the ones who had plunged her into despair following the cruel and unusual post-World War I Treaty of Versailles. now marveled at Germany's resurgence. Former British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, soon after having visited Hitler in 1936, had this to say: "It is not the Germany of the decade that followed the war, broken, dejected, and bowed down with a sense of apprehension and impotence. It is now full of hope and confidence, and of a renewed sense of determination to lead its own life without interference from any influence outside of its own frontiers. One man has accomplished this miracle. He is a born leader of men, a magnetic and dynamic personality with a single-minded purpose, a resolute will, and a dauntless heart. As to his popularity, there can be no manner of doubt. The old trust him. The young idolize him. It is not the admiration accorded to a popular leader. It is the worship of a national hero who has saved his country from utter despondence and degradation. I have never met a happier people than the Germans." That's very interesting. Hitler also had some defenders in America, including the hero of the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games, Jesse Owens. Owens not only refuted the myth of Hitler having snubbed him because he was black, but he went on to take American reporters to task for disrespecting the man he referred to as the man of the hour. Most astonishing of all is the concessions made by Hitler's future nemesis, Winston Churchill. In an article for Strand magazine, Churchill, in describing Germany's resurrection, writes, "One may dislike Hitler's systems and yet admire his patriotic achievement. If our country were defeated, I hope we should find a champion as indomitable to restore our courage and lead us back to our place among the nations." Interesting. I did not know. That Winston Churchill said that. But further down the article, the objective Churchill drops the other shoe by suggesting that Germany may possibly yet turn out to be a threat to world peace. "We cannot tell whether Hitler will be the man who will once again let loose upon the world another war in which civilization will irretrievably succumb, or whether he will go down in history as the man who restored honor and peace of mind to the great Germanic nation and brought them back to serene, helpful, and strong, the European family circle. It is on the mystery of the future that history will pronounce Hitler either as a monster or a hero. It is this which will determine whether he will rank in Valhalla with Pericles, with Augustus, and with Washington, or welter in the inferno of human scorn with Attila and Tamerlane. It is enough to say that both possibilities are open at the present moment." The German press and foreign ministry were quick to express displeasure with Churchill's underhanded and speculative comparison of Hitler to genocidal Hun and Mongol leaders from antiquity. But Churchill's anti-German campaign was just getting started, along with his rise to political influence. And the official version of World War II history is correct. Then Churchill's warning, issued at a time, November 1935, when so many other big names were praising Hitler's accomplishments, was indeed prophetic. But if Adolf Hitler's version of World War II his story is correct, then Churchill's warning amounted to a self-fulfilling prophecy. Hence, it was no prophecy at all. Let us begin Hitler's side of the story in March of 1938, a full 18 months before the kickoff of World War II. Again, keep in mind that, even Churchill and so many others have admitted, Hitler's happy Germany is neither harming nor threatening anyone at this point in time. Okay. These are the footnotes for the search terms, so he's changed how he's done a little bit here. All right, address number one. This is March the 12th, 1938. On the merger with Austria. And I don't know if a lot of you guys know that Austria-Hungary, remember when Austria-Hungary was one country, and they were the second country. That's, in fact, they were the, it was the prince Archduke Ferdinand, who was the Prince of Austria-Hungary, and he went down into Sarajevo, into Yugoslavia, because Yugoslavian territory was, I think, was being occupied by Austria-Hungary. They had kind of taken it over. But after World War One, all those countries were like ripped apart, and Austria was on its own. Background: following World War One, the Austria-Hungary Empire was disintegrated by the victorious Allies. The newly created state of Austria, Hitler's birthplace, was forbidden from becoming part of Germany. Official history: Hitler strong-armed his Austrian homeland into forced annexation, or the Anschluss. Mine's out of the story. The oppressed people of Austria wished to unite with Germany, but were forbidden by the West and their puppet Austrian government. Austrians welcomed me with open arms as their liberator. And this was a radio, broadcast, written by Hitler and read by Goebbels. Germans, for years, we have witnessed the fate of our fellow Germans in Austria with deep distress, an eternal historical bond severed only by the events of the year 1866, but forged anew in the World War, has from time immemorial destined Austria to take its place in the German national community and share its fate. The suffering which was imposed on this country, first from the outside and then from within, we experienced as our own, and we know that the misfortunes of the Reich caused millions of German Austrians similar anxiety and concern. When the German nation regained the proud self-confidence of a great people, thanks to the triumph of the ideals of National Socialism, in Austria, a new period of suffering and most bitter adversity began. A regime with no legal mandate was attempting, by means of the most brutal terror and physical mistreatment, as well as punitive and destructive economic measures, to maintain an existence which was rejected by the vast majority of the Austrian people. Thus, we as a great people saw how numerically small minority, which had simply been able to seize the necessary instruments of power, was suppressing more than 6 million people with whom we share a common origin. Their political disenfranchisement and the deprivation of their freedom were accompanied by an economic decline, which was a shocking contrast to the blossoming of a new life in Germany. Who could blame these unfortunate fellow Germans if they looked toward the Reich with longing eyes? To that Germany with which their forefathers had been united for so many centuries, with which they had once fought shoulder to shoulder in the most terrible of all wars, whose culture was their culture, and to which they themselves had contributed their most cherished values in so many areas. To suppress these longings was to condemn hundreds of thousands of people to the most profound spiritual distress. Whereas years ago, this suffering was still borne patiently as the prestige of the Reich steadily increased, to the determination to end this oppression became stronger and stronger. Germans, in recent years, I have tried to warn the former rulers in Austria not to continue on this path. Only a maniac could believe that suppression and terror can deprive human beings of their love of their own people. European history proves that this causes nothing more intense fanaticism. This fanaticism then forces the suppressor to employ ever crueler and violent methods, which in turn only increases the revulsion and hatred felt by the victims of this violence. I also tried to convince those in power that in the long run it is impossible, because it is unworthy for a great nation to be forced constantly to watch as a people of their same nationality are persecuted and incarcerated merely because of their origin, or their allegiance to a people, or to their dedication to an idea. Germany alone has had to accept more than 40,000 refugees. 10,000 others have been in jails, prison cells, and holding camps in this small land. Hundreds of thousands have been made beggars, reduced to misery and poverty in the long run. In the long run, no nation in the world could tolerate such conditions on its borders without itself deserving same disrespect. In 1936, I tried to find some way which could offer the prospect of alleviating the tragic fate of this German brother nation, and in this way, perhaps achieve genuine reconciliation. The agreement of July 11 was signed only to be breached a moment later. The vast majority remained deprived of their rights. The humiliating position as a pariah in this state was no way changed. Anyone who openly supported the idea of one German nation continued to be persecuted, no matter whether he was a National Socialist street laborer or an old meritorious army commander who had fought in the World War. I tried a second time to reach an understanding. I attempted to explain to the representatives of this regime who, without any legitimate mandate of his own, stood before me in my capacity as the elected leader of the German people. I tried to explain to him that in the long run, this situation would become intolerable since the growing outrage of the Austrian people could not be suppressed forever by increasing the use of force, and that from a certain point in time, the Reich would find it impossible to continue to stand by and silently observe such outrageous treatment. Today, when even the solution to colonial problems must take into consideration the right of inferior nations to self-determination, it is intolerable that 6.5 million members of an old and great civilized people are in practical terms deprived of these rights by the nature of the governing regime. Hence, in a new agreement, I wanted all Germans in this country to be granted the same rights and be subject to the same obligations. This agreement was to fulfill the terms of the Treaty of July 11, 1936. A few weeks later, it unfortunately became obvious that the men of the Austrian government in power at the time had no intention of complying with these terms of this agreement. However, in order to acquire an alibi for their continued failure to grant equal rights to the Austrian Germans, a plebiscite was devised which intended to finally deprive the majority of this country of its rights. The modalities of this procedure were to be unique. A country which had not had an election for many years, which lacks all of the documentation required to compile voters' lists, announces a vote to which is take place within just 3.5 days. There are no electoral lists. There are no voters' cards. There is no scrutiny of the eligibility to vote. There is no obligation to preserve secret ballots. There is no guarantee that the voting will be conducted with impartiality. There is no method of ensuring fair counting of the votes, and so on. If these are the methods to give regime legality, then we National Socialists in the German Reich were utter fools for 15 years. We went through 100 election campaigns and took great pains to gain the approval of the German people. When the late Reich president finally called upon me to form the government, I was the leader of the party which had by far the strongest support in the Reich. Since then, I have repeatedly sought to have the legality of my existence and my actions confirmed by the German people, and it was confirmed. In the methods Herr Schuschnigg wanted to use were the right ones, then the plebiscite we once held in the Saar can only have been a device to harass a people whose return to the Reich we wanted to make more difficult. We, however, do not subscribe to that view. I believe we can all be proud that it was in the very plebiscite in the Saar that we received an indisputable vote of confidence from the German people. The German people of Austria themselves finally rose up in protest against this unprecedented attempt at election fraud. If, however, it was again the intention of the regime to simply crush the protest movement with brute force, the result could only be a new civil war. The German Reich will, however, henceforth not permit Germans to be persecuted in this territory because of their membership in our nation or because they profess certain views. It wants peace and order. I have therefore decided to offer the millions of Germans in Austria the assistance of the Reich. Since this morning, soldiers of the German armed forces have been crossing all of the German-Austrian borders, armored units, infantry divisions, and SS units on the ground, and the German Luftwaffe in the skies, summoned by the new National Socialist government in Vienna, will ensure that the Austrian people are within the very near future finally given the opportunity to determine for themselves their future and thus their fate. Though through a genuine plebiscite, and these units are supported by the will and determination of the entire German nation, I myself, as Führer and Chancellor of the German people, will be happy once again to be able to enter the country, which is also my homeland as a German, and as a free citizen. The world, however, shall see for itself that the German people in Austria these days are filled with hours of blissful joy and deep emotion. They regard their brothers who have come to their aid as saviors who have rescued them from this great from great distress. Long live the National Socialist German Reich. Long live National Socialist German Austria. And then these are pictures of the people as German soldiers are marching in. Delirious Austrians give Hitler a hero's welcome. And then image six, which is this one right here, is Hitler laying a wreath at the gravesite of his parents. All right. Address number two, October 1st, 1938. On the crisis in Czechoslovakia. So, let me pull this map out. Find the map. Where did I put it? Give me a second, guys. Here we go. No, Eve. Different program here. Here we go. Okay. All right. So, what you see here is this is Austria, down in here. I can't write on this. Make this bigger. So here is Austria, Hungary, right in here, right? And then this is Slovakia or Czechoslovakia right here. Bohemia, Moravia, and Prague right in there. So, and that is a little bit... and then this was the Sudetenland. The Sudetenland was a portion of Czechoslovakia, which they had taken away from Germany and given to Czechoslovakia. Background. After World War I, an area of 3 million German inhabitants was forced to become part of the new state of Czechoslovakia. The Sudetenland Germans wished to join Germany. Official story. As at the Munich Conference of 1938, Hitler strong-armed Neville Chamberlain of Britain and Daladier of France into giving him the Sudetenland and dissolving Czechoslovakia. After Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler, Germany snatched the Sudetenland. My side of the story. The abuse of the Sudetenland Germans at the hands of Edvard Beneš could no longer be tolerated. Nobody appeased me. The Munich Conference was a fair and just settlement that avoided the war. That avoided war. And then this was Adolf Hitler's address to the Reichstag. For months, Germans in the Sudetenland have been suffering under the torture of the Czechoslovak government. This is a problem which the Versailles Diktat created, a problem which has deteriorated until it became intolerable for us. The Sudeten German population was and is a German. The German minority living there has been ill-treated in the most distressing manner. More than 1 million people of German blood had, in the years 1919 to 1920, to leave their homeland. As always, I attempted to bring about by the peaceful method of making proposals for revision and alteration of this intolerable position. It was a lie when the outside world said that we only tried to carry it through our revisions by pressure. 15 years before the National Socialist Party came to power, there was the opportunity of carrying out these revisions by peaceful settlements and understanding. On my own initiative, I have not once, but several times, made proposals for the revision of intolerable conditions. All of these proposals, as you know, have been rejected. Proposals for limitation of armaments and, even if necessary, disarmament. Proposals for limitation of war-making. Proposals for the elimination of certain methods of modern warfare. You know, the proposals that I have made to fulfill the necessity of restoring German sovereignty over German territories. You know, the endless attempts I made for a peaceful clarification and understanding of the problem of Austria and now the Sudetenland. It was all in vain. Despite pressure from both us, Italy, France, and Britain on the Czechoslovakia to cede the Sudetenland to us, Beneš, who's the Czech president, has as many times before refused to abide by the agreement. And the persecution of the Sudeten German minorities continue with his blessing. This night, the German population in Sudetenland was victim for a massacre carried out by the Czechoslovak army, which claimed the lives of 32 civilians. Since 5:45 a.m., we have answered the call of the Sudeten Germans to assure their safety. And from now on, terror will be terror. The oppressing regime in Prague must be stopped. Whoever fights with bombs will be fought with bombs. Whoever departs from the rules of humane warfare can only expect that we shall do the same. I will continue this struggle, no matter against whom, until the safety of the Reich and its rights are secured. For 5 years now, I have been working on the building up of the German defenses. Over 90 million have in that time been spent on the building up of these defense forces. They are now the best equipped and are above all comparison with what they were in 1914. My trust in them is unshakable. When I call upon these forces and when I now ask sacrifices of the German people and, if necessary, every sacrifice, then I have a right to do so. For I also am today absolutely ready, just as we were formerly, to make every possible sacrifice. I am asking of no German man more than myself. I was ready throughout 4 years at any time to do. There will be no hardships for Germans to which I myself will not submit. My whole life henceforth belongs more than ever to my people. I am from now on just first soldier of the German Reich. I have once more put on that coat that was the most sacred and dear to me. I will not take it off again until victory is secured, or I will not survive the outcome. Should anything happen to me in the struggle, then my first successor is party comrade Göring. Should anything happen to him, to party comrade Göring, my next successor is party comrade Hess. You should then be under obligation to give to them as Führer the same blind loyalty and obedience as to myself. Should anything happen to party comrade Hess, then by law, the Senate will be called, and we will choose from the midst of the most worthy, that is to say, the bravest successor. As a National Socialist and as a German soldier, I enter upon this struggle with a stout heart. My whole life has been nothing but one long struggle for my people and its restoration and for Germany. There was only one watchword for that struggle. Faith in this people, one word I have never learned, that is surrender. If, however, anyone thinks that we are facing a hard time, I should ask him to remember that once a Prussian king with a ridiculously small state opposed a stronger coalition and in three wars finally came out successful because that state had the stout heart we need in these times. Let's see here, the real special, this is another one. If you can, please tell me the name of the series you did about Europa. Okay, I'll have to find that special ed. I'll have to find that. It's I didn't name it Europa on purpose, but I didn't play all 10 episodes. I think I played 8 of them. But I named them in a way that I did that it would cause people to, you know, be curious about looking into it, and as opposed to naming it Europa. So, but I'll tell you the dates and put links up to those. If you could do me a favor, Special Ed, don't comment in the live chat, put the comment in the comment section of the video. So to remind me. All right. I would therefore like to assure the entire world that a November 1918 will never be repeated in German history. Just as I myself am ready to at any time to stake my life, anyone can take it from my people and for Germany. So I ask the same of all others. Whoever, however, thinks he can oppose this national command, whether directly or indirectly, shall fall. We have nothing to do with traitors. We are all faithful to our old principle. It is quite unimportant whether we ourselves live, but it is essential that our people shall live, that Germany shall live. The sacrifice that is demanded of us is not greater than the sacrifice that many generations have made. If we form a community closely bound together by vows, ready for anything, resolved never to surrender, then our will master every hardship and difficulty. I don't think that was what it's supposed to say. Then we will master every hardship and difficulty. I think that's probably more appropriate. And I would like to close with a declaration that I once made when I began the struggle for power in the Reich. I said then, if our will is so strong that no hardship and suffering can subdue it, then our will and our German might shall prevail. And then I'm guessing that these are pictures of when they marched into the Sudetenland. Now, this one's going to be really interesting because this is going to be talking about Poland and Danzig and the Danzig corridor. Address number 3, August 28th, 1939, a plea for peace on the eve of war. Background. Following World War I, the German area of West Prussia was forced to become part of the new state of Poland. West Prussians and residents of the German free city of Danzig were forbidden from becoming part of Germany, while East Prussia was cut off from the German mainland. Official history, Hitler accused Poland of killing Germans as a pretext to invade. My side of the story. Emboldened and prodded by the warmongers in Britain and France, Poland's murderous abuse of its German inhabitants, along with its deliberate border provocations against Germany, could no longer be tolerated. And I'm guessing that he's going to touch upon this, but if you go and you look here at this tiny little corridor again, let me see if I can find that map and show you. Okay, so here's Danzig right here on the map, right? And this is East Prussia. And East Prussia was actually still part of Germany. And then here's Germany. So there was a corridor here where you had people in this area that were German, but were not allowed to be united in Germany. And they were in Poland. And the Polish military under the leader was basically, they were brutalizing anybody who was of German descent. I mean, they'd go in and they were torturing them. They like poke their eyes out with bayonets. They, bash their heads in with rifles. I mean, I think there was something like 50,000 people that were killed by the Polish military people of Germanic heritage who were civilians. So, in that little area there. All right. And don't quote me on all those numbers, but I'm just kind of giving you the overall picture. All right, and here's a written communique to French President Daladier. My dear Minister President, I understand the misgivings to which you give expression. I too have never overlooked the grave responsibilities which are imposed upon those who you are in charge of, the fate of nations. As an old frontline fighter, I, like you, know the horrors of war. Guided by this attitude and experience, I have tried to remove all matters that might cause conflict between our two peoples. I have, quite frankly, given one assurance to the French people, namely that the return of the Tsar would constitute the precondition for this. And the Tsar was a region. The Tsar was a region in. Let me see here if I can, if it shows up on here. The Tsar is right here. So you see where it says Tsarland, 1935. So the Tsar was this area right in here. Let's see. I quite frankly have given one assurance to the French people, namely that the return of the Tsar would constitute the precondition for this. After its return, I immediately and solemnly pronounced to my renunciation of any further claims that might concern France. The German people approved of this, my attitude. As you could judge for yourself during your last visit here, the German people, in the knowledge of its own behavior, held and holds no ill feelings, much less hatred, for its one-time brave opponent. On the contrary, the pacification of our western frontier led to an increasing sympathy, certainly as far as the German people are concerned, a sympathy which on many occasions showed itself in a really demonstrative way. The construction of the Western fortifications, which swallowed and still swallow many millions at the time, constructed for Germany a document of acceptance and fixation of the final frontiers of the Reich. In doing so, the German people have renounced two provinces, one which once belonged to Germany, later were conquered again at the cost of much blood, and finally defended with even more blood. I believe by this renunciation and this attitude, every conceivable source of conflict between our two peoples that might lead to a repetition of the tragedy of 1418 has been done away with. This voluntary limitation of the German claims to life in the West can, however, not be interpreted as an acceptance of all other phases of the Versailles dictate. I have really tried, year after year, to achieve the revision of at least the most impossible and unbearable provisions of this dictate by way of negotiation. This was impossible. In this sense, I have tried to remove from all the world the most irrational provisions of the Versailles dictate. I have made an offer to the Polish government which shocked the German people. No one but me could even dare go before the public with such an offer. It could therefore be made only once. I am deeply convinced that if, especially, England at the time had, instead of starting a wild campaign against Germany in the press and insisted, and instead of launching rumors of German mobilization, somehow talked to the Poles into being reasonable, Europe today and for 25 years could enjoy a condition of deepest peace. As things were, Polish public opinion was excited by a lie about German aggression. Clear decisions that the situation called for were made difficult for the Polish government. Above all, the government's ability to see the limitations of realistic possibilities was impaired by the guarantee promises that followed. The Polish government declined the proposals. Polish public opinion, convinced that England and France would now fight for Poland, began to make demands one might possibly stigmatize as laughable insanity were they not so tremendously dangerous. And at that point, an unbearable terror, a physical and economic persecution of the Germans, although they numbered more than 1.5 million, began in the region ceded by the Reich. Basically, what he's saying here, he says that Germany and or is that Poland was promised by France and England that they were going to fight for them if Germany did anything to them. And he's like, that's just retarded. That's laughable. Says, I do not want to speak of the atrocities that occurred. Suffice it to say that Danzig, too, was made increasingly conscious through continuous aggressive acts by Polish officials of the fact that apparently it was delivered over to the high-handedness of a power born to the national character of the city and its population. May I now take the liberty of putting a question to you, Herr Daladier? How would you act as a Frenchman if, through some unhappy issue of a brave struggle, one of your provinces severed by a corridor occupied by a foreign power, and if a big city, let us say Marseille, were hindered from belonging to France, and if Frenchmen living in this area were persecuted, beaten, and maltreated, yes, murdered in a bestial manner? You are a Frenchman, Herr Daladier, and I therefore know how you would act. I am German, Herr Daladier. Do not doubt my sense of honor nor my consciousness of duty to act exactly like you. If, then, you had the misfortune that is ours, would you then, Herr Daladier, have any understanding that Germany was without cause to insist that the corridor through France remain, that the robbed territory must not be restored, and that the return of Marseille be forbidden? Certainly, I cannot imagine, Herr Daladier, that Germany would fight against you for this reason, for I and all of us have renounced Alsace-Lorraine in order to avoid further bloodshed. Much less would we shed blood in order to maintain an injustice that would be unbearable for you as it would be immaterial for to us. Man, some heavy writing. Sorry. Possibly we, as old front fighters, can best understand each other in a number of fields. I ask you, however, do understand this also, that it is impossible for a nation of honor to renounce the claim of almost 2 million human beings and to them maltreated at its own borders. I have therefore set up a clear demand to Poland. Danzig and the corridor must return to Germany. I see no way of persuading Poland, which feels herself as unassailable now that she enjoys the protection of her guarantees, to accept a peaceful solution. If our two countries on that account should be destined to meet again on the field of battle, there would nevertheless be a difference in the motives. I, Herr Daladier, shall be leading my people in a fight to rectify a wrong, whereas the others would be fighting to preserve that wrong. That is the more tragic, since more important men also among your own people have recognized the insanity of the solutions then found at Versailles, as also the possibility of maintaining it lastingly. That our two peoples should enter a new bloody war of destruction is painful, not only for you, but also for me, Herr Delavere. As already observed, I see no possibility for us on our part to exert influence in the direction of reasonableness upon Poland for correcting a situation that is unbearable for the German people and the German Reich. So this is a newspaper in the New York Times. Hitler tells Paris he must get Danzig and corridor. Berlin thinks the door is left open to peaceful solution. British answer today to insist on rights of Poland. So, and then this is, I think, when was this written? The letter was penned on August 28th of 39. And then this was, I think they went in on September the 1st of 39. All right. There you go. I'll probably end with this and then pick it up, pick the remainder of it up on Wednesday. So on the war with Poland, Britain and France are holding firm on the war guarantees that they had issued to Poland. The official history on September 1st, 1939, Hitler believing that France and Britain will back down, orders the invasion of Poland. The Allies swiftly declare war on Germany. My side of the story. There were no more options. The Polish dictator was determined to have a war of territorial expansion, pushed on by the war guarantees of France and Britain. Poland started the war, not me. And then this is the address. This is the abridged address to the Reichstag by Hitler. Deputies, men of the German Reichstag, for months a problem has tormented all of us. Long ago, the dictate of the Versailles bestowed this problem. Anyone find it weird that the beginning and end of World War II was almost to the day? Well, you're talking about two different things, though, because the Japanese were actually already in Manchuria at this time. And I think the Japanese were fighting it as early as 1938, maybe even 37. And the war in Europe ended in May. The war didn't end in the Pacific until August. So it is true that, I mean, the official start of World War II is cited as as September 1st, and the official ending of it in total was in August, but in different theaters. But I get your point. I digress. All right. Long ago, the dictate of Versailles bestowed this problem on us. In its depravity and degeneracy, it has now become insufferable. Danzig was a German city and is a German city. The corridor was German and is German. These regions owe their cultural development exclusively to the German folk. Without the German folk, these eastern regions would still be plunged in the depths of barbarism. Danzig was torn from us. Poland annexed the corridor along with the other German territories in the east. The German minorities living there are being persecuted in the vilest manner imaginable. Already in the years 1919 and 1920, over 1 million ethnic Germans were forced off of their lands. As always, I also sought here to bring about a change by peaceful means, by offering proposals to remedy this situation, which, meanwhile, had become unbearable. It is a lie when others... It is a lie when others in the world claim that we proceeded only with pressure. 15 years before the National Socialist rise to leadership, there was ample opportunity to carry out these revisions by peaceful means. Nothing of the sort was done. In every single case, I made proposals for a revision not once, but many times to revise these intolerable conditions. You know that all these proposals were rejected. There is no need for me to enumerate them. My proposals on the limitation of arms, if necessary, even for the complete elimination of weaponry, my proposals for limited warfare, for the abolition of methods employed in modern warfare, which, in my eyes, are hardly reconcilable with international law. You know of my proposals on the necessity of restoring German sovereignty over the German Reich territory. You know of the endless attempts I made for a peaceful resolution and coming to some understanding regarding the Austrian situation, and later over the issues regarding the Sudetenland, Bohemia, and Moravia. It was all for naught. There is one thing that is simply not possible: to demand that an unworkable condition be resolved by means of peaceful revision and then to consistently deny resolution by peaceful means. It is likewise not possible to claim that one who, under the circumstances, resorts to resolving the situation by himself, who undertakes the revisions on his own, is in breach of the law. For the dictate of Versailles does not constitute law for us Germans. It was forced on us. You simply cannot uphold and proclaim a signature to represent sanctified law when it was extorted by holding a pistol to the signatory's head and threatening to starve millions of human beings if he failed to comply. Thus, I attempted also in the case of Danzig and the corridor to obtain a resolution to the deteriorating conditions by means of proposals and their peaceful discussion. To these ends, problems had to be resolved. It was entirely clear that the Western states were possibly unconcerned with the timetable is understandable. Yet this timetable is not indifferent to us, and most of all, it was not and could not be indifferent to the victims who suffered the most. In my talks with Polish statesmen, I once more expounded those thoughts which you already heard in my last speech before the Reichstag. No man can accuse me of employing inappropriate methods or of applying undue pressure. If it was I who had the German proposals formulated in the end, and I must repeat here that there is nothing more modest or loyal than these proposals. I should like to say this to the world. I alone was in the position to make such proposals. I know very well that in doing so, I brought myself into opposition to millions of Germans. These proposals have been rejected, and not only that, they were answered by and with an intensified force on the ethnic Germans in those regions. Further, a deliberate throttling assault took place in the free city of Danzig, commercially and politically, with custom duty maneuvers, then finally, in the last few weeks, exploits in a military and traffic logistics took hold. Poland has unleashed a battle against the free city of Danzig. It was further not willing to solve the corridor question in the least costly way that would have rendered justice to the inherent interests of both parties. And ultimately, it had not been concerned with upholding its responsibilities towards its ethnic minorities. And here, I must establish the fact that Germany has fulfilled its obligations. The minorities living within the Reich are not subject to persecution. There is not one Frenchman who can stand up to claim that 50 to 100,000 French living in the Tsar territory are being oppressed, tortured, or robbed of their rights. Not one can claim as much. I have been silently standing by and observing the situation for 4 months now. Yet I have issued warnings repeatedly, and I have intensified these warnings of late. As long as 3 weeks ago, I already had the Polish ambassador informed that if Poland should send further notes to Danzig in the nature of an ultimatum, if it should implement further repression measures against the Germans there, or if Poland should attempt to destroy Danzig economically by imposing high customs on it, then Germany could simply no longer be expected to stand by without taking action. I left no doubt that it would be a grave mistake in this context to compare the Germany of today to the Germany of days past. if there were attempts to justify their actions against the ethnic Germans by claiming that these constituted a response to prior provocations, I know not what type of provocations those women and children had allegedly perpetrated who were abused and abducted, nor can I imagine what provocations had been perpetrated by those who were the most sadistically and the most bestially tortured, only to be murdered in the end, that I do not know. Yet there is one thing I do know. No honorable great country could calmly tolerate such a state of affairs in the long run. Nevertheless, I made one last effort, and this even though in my heart I was convinced that the Polish government, especially given its dependence on the rabble of soldiers now freed of inhibitions, was not serious about attaining a true understanding. Nevertheless, I tried one last time to accept a mediation proposal from the British government. The British suggested that while they were not willing to negotiate themselves, they suggested and guaranteed to open a direct line of communication between Poland and Germany to initiate talks once more. And now I am forced to state the following. I accepted this proposal. It was for this new round of negotiations that I drafted the proposals known to you. For two whole days, I sat with my government and waited to see whether it was convenient for the Polish government to send a plenipotentiary or not. Up to last night, it had not commissioned any such plenipotentiary. Rather, it informed us through the offices of its ambassador that it presently contemplating whether or not it is in a position to consider the English proposals and that they would let England know. My deputies, should someone have the impertinence to expect the German Reich and its head of state to tolerate this? And should the German Reich and its head of state tolerate this, then truly the German nation would deserve no better than to take leave of the political stage. For I am wrongly judged if my love for peace and my patience are mistaken for weakness or even cowardice. Last night, I informed the British government that, under the circumstances, I no longer see any willingness by the Polish government to enter into serious negotiations with us, and thus, all attempts at mediation must be considered to have failed, for we had indeed received a response to our proposals which consisted of general mobilization in Poland and renewed heinous atrocities. These incidents repeated themselves in the course of the night, and this after the recent perpetration of 21 border transgressions in the span of just one single night. Yesterday, 14 additional violations of the border were recorded, among them three of a most serious nature. I have therefore resolved to speak to Poland in the same language that Poland has employed toward us in the months past. Now that statesmen in the West go about declaring that these infringes on their interests, I can only regret this position. This cannot and will not, however, make me waver for a minute in the fulfillment of my duty. What more is wanted from us? I have solemnly assured the Western states, and I repeat this here, that we desire nothing of them. We shall never demand anything of them in the future. I have assured them that the border separating France and Germany is a final one. Time and time again, I have offered friendship and, if necessary, closest cooperation to England. But love cannot be offered from one side only. It must be met with reciprocation by the other side. Germany is not pursuing any interests in the West. The West Wall delineates the Reich's border for all time. Our ambitions for the future are no different, and nothing shall ever change the Reich's standpoint in this matter. The other European states, in part, comprehend our stance. Here, I wish above all to thank Italy, which lent us support during the entire time. You will understand that we do not wish to appeal to a foreign power for assistance in this struggle. This is our task, and we shall carry out our responsibilities by ourselves. The neutral states have already assured us of their neutrality. We earlier guaranteed them our neutrality. Our assurances are made in sacred earnestness. As long as other powers do not violate this neutrality, we shall likewise respect them scrupulously. Scrupulously. For how could we do, how could we wish to or desire to conduct ourselves differently towards these states? I am happy to be able to inform you on, of a very special development at this point. You know that two different doctrines govern Russia and Germany. There remained but one question that needed to be clarified. Germany has no intent of exporting its doctrine, and at the moment, that Soviet Russia no longer contemplates exporting its doctrine to Germany. I no longer see any compelling reason, not even once, why we should continue to take opposing stances. To both of us, it is completely clear that any struggle between our two peoples would merely benefit others. Hence, we have determined to enter into a pact which shall preclude the application of force between us for all times. It also obliges us to seek mutual consultation in certain European questions. Moreover, it shall render possible economic cooperation and, above all, ensure that the strength of the two great states is not squandered in rivalry with each other. Any attempt by the West to change this is doomed to failure. And one thing I would like to assure us all here today is the decision signals a fundamental change for the future, and it is a final one. I believe the entire German folk welcomes this political resolve. Russia and Germany fought each other in World War only for both to become victims in the end. This shall not and will not happen a second time. Yesterday in Moscow and Berlin, the non-aggression and mutual consultation pact, which had originally entered into force upon signature, was accorded final ratification. In Moscow, this pact was warmly received, as you receive it here. I second every word of the Russian Foreign Commissar Molotov's speech. Our goals, I am determined to resolve the question of Danzig and the question of the corridor, and to see it to that a change of German-Polish relations as to warrant peaceful coexistence. I am equally determined to wage this war until the present Polish government is willing to bring about these conditions, or another Polish government shall be willing to do so. I will cleanse Germany's borders of this element of insecurity, this civil war-like circumstance. I will take care that our border in the east enjoys the same peace as along any other of our borders. I will take the measures necessary in an approach that does not contradict what I have pronounced to be my proposals to the world before you, my deputies, and the Reichstag. This means I do not wish to lead this war against women and children. I have ordered my Luftwaffe to limit its attacks to military objectives. Should, however, the enemy regard this as giving him license to employ reverse measures against us, then he shall receive an answer that will knock him senseless. Last night, for the first time, Polish regular soldiers invaded our territory and attacked from our soil. We have now been returning fire since 5:45 a.m. Henceforth, bomb will be met with bomb. He who fights with poison shall be fought with poison gas. He who distances himself from the rules for a humane conduct of warfare can only expect us to take like steps. I will lead this battle, whoever the adversary may be, until the security of the Reich and its rights have been assured. For over 6 years, I've worked on the rearmament of the German Wehrmacht. I have spent over 90 billion Reichsmarks for this. Today it is the best equipped in the entire world and defies comparison to our military of 1914. My confidence in it is unshakable. When I call upon this Wehrmacht and when I now demand sacrifice from the German folk, even the ultimate sacrifice, should there be need, then I have a right to do this, because today I am as willing as I was before to make any personal sacrifice. I am asking of no German man more than I volunteered for and was ready to do for 4 years. Germans should not be asked to make any sacrifices I myself would not make without an instant hesitation. I now wish to be nothing other than the first soldier of the German Reich. Therefore, I have put on that tunic which has always been the most holy and dear to me. I shall not take it off again until after victory is ours, or I shall not live to see the day. Should something happen to me in this war, my immediate successor shall be Goring. I would like to assure the world around us of one thing: there shall never be another November 1918 in German history. provided all us form parties of this community, sworn together, determined never to capitulate, and our will shall master all need. I conclude with the declaration I once made as I began my struggle for leadership in the Reich. Back then I said, when our will is strong enough that need can no longer vanquish it, then our will and our German steel will vanquish and conquer need. Deutschland, Sieg Heil. So, anyway, the looking at this, I'm going to kind of give a few historical things here, and then I'll end. But Poland was given assurances by England and France that they would go to war on their behalf. Well, what Hitler did is he went to Russia and he asked Russia to go in. He asked Russia for a non-aggression pact. They willingly did it. I don't think they really trusted each other. But at the time, what he did was, if Poland was going to be defended by France and England, if Russia invaded France and England, then that would mean that England and France would also have to go to war with Russia. So, you know, everybody knows that Germany invaded Poland, but not very many people realize that Russia also invaded Poland from the east. They kind of met in the middle. They basically divided Poland up. But France and England never declared war on Russia for the exact same thing that they declared war on Germany for. You got to understand that the war, you know, Hitler was trying to seek a peaceful solution to, it would be like if, let's say that Florida was part of the United States, but Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi were ceded to Mexico, and there was a separation there, and you had people that were Americans that were living in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, who were being mistreated by the Mexican army. They were being butchered. And say there was a major city, Mobile, Alabama, which was, you know, being, which was a port that where things came in, and these huge tariffs that were being put on things, that were causing, high prices for the end user, especially in that corridor. Well, do you think that if Trump was president, he would be like, no, hell no. That ain't going to happen. We ain't letting you do that. And then he had the best military in the world. And he says, all right, we're going to go in there and handle business. Well, I mean, Poland surrendered in like 3 weeks. I mean, Poland didn't survive, but like 3 weeks. And Germany and France never came to their aid, ever. I mean, they did a little bit. They came over. I think the British army came over, and then they had some skirmishes with the German army. But the Germans came in and pushed them into the sea, and then they stopped at Dunkirk and let the British army escape. So, anyway, let me look at some of the comments here. Let's see. No, not Mein Kampf. This was called My Side of the Story. This is basically, these are speeches members of the German government, mostly Hitler, were giving to people, or letters that they had written to foreign ambassadors or foreign presidents or whatnot. So, Assange is free. Huh? When did that happen? Are you serious? Really? Wow. 15 minutes ago. That's crazy. Well, we'll see what happens there. Lots of stuff going on. He pled out? Huh. Interesting. Well, let me show this here real quick, because this is relevant to the situation. So these are pictures. This is the dreams of restoring Poland's long gone empire danced in Emperor Smigli's mind. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to have Polish Empire, the Polish Lithuanian Empire, go all the way into like Ukraine and whatnot. So, you know, clearly he had ambitions. These are really okay. So I'm just going to read them, because it's murdered and castrated body of a minority German found near Bromberg. Yeah, not yet identified. And then this says, here lie 18 bodies found on the bank of the Bromberg Canal. It's really fuzzy. Among them, the two bodies of there are two bodies of two children. With the exception of a few, all of the dead had their heads or had their hands tied behind their back. And I'm guessing that it says here, the torture and mutilation massacre at Bromberg occurred just 2 days after the liberating Germans arrived in Western Prussia. The brutality of the mass killing gave an indication of the type of abuse that the innocent Germans trapped in Poland had been suffering, while Smigli looked the other way. Smigli being the emperor of Poland. So we'll pick up next time on address 5 of the victory speech in Danzig. So that is where we will pick up next time. So y'all have a good evening, and I will see you guys tomorrow. I'm not sure if we're going to have, I'm not sure where Doug is, if we're going to have the Constitution class, but we definitely will have the, definitely have the Tuesday with Mike, and we're going to be doing something with Japan. We're going to talk about Japan tomorrow night. So anyway, hope you guys all enjoy your evening, and I will see you manana. Have a good night, everybody.